Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded July 2nd, 2024. Well, while the Democratic Party machine churns still for the president's re-election, those believing Joe Biden's impersonation of a headlamp deer during his first and possibly final presidential debate last week spells his demise are likely right, but only partially so. Yes, Biden's performance was less politically survivable than a Boeing one-point landing, but what dies with him, too, is a taproot running deeper than just the 50-plus year career of a single servant to big business in Washington. Jeremy Kuzmarov is a scholar, journalist, and author. He holds a PhD in American history and has taught at various institutions of higher learning across the U.S. Jeremy, too, writes for Covert Action magazine and serves as its managing editor. Kuzmarov's book titles include Obama's Unending Wars, The Russians Are Coming Again, written with John Marciano, and his latest Warmonger, How Clinton's Malign Foreign Policy Launched the U.S. Trajectory from Bush 2 to Biden. His recent article at CAM is Joe Biden's Mentor, Father of Original Cold War, Was Traitor to U.S., examines the political provenance of the current president. Jeremy Kuzmarov in the first half. And as Canada observed its colonial foundation, one of its past foreign government assets settled into his new life in an American penitentiary. Strangely, few Canadian media outlets reported former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez's sentencing in the Southern District Federal Court of New York for his role in importing 400 tons of cocaine into the U.S. while in office, among other things. But then perhaps that's not such a surprise, given the role Ottawa played in securing Hernandez's and his predecessors' questionable tenures in Tegucigalpa. Eve Angler is a Montreal-based political activist and the author of 13 books, including Canada in Hating, Waging War on the Poor Majority with Anthony Fenton, and his latest, co-authored with Owen Schock, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, which he's recently toured across the country. Eve's also a prolific essayist whose writing appears across the internet and at his website, eveangler.com, where I found his recent piece, Canada's Guy in Honduras, Sentenced to 45 Years in Prison. Eve Angler and Canadian Political Interference at Work Abroad in the second half. But first, Jeremy Kuzmarov and the man who made Joe Biden. Welcome back to the show, Jeremy.
Great to be with you again. Always a pleasure.
Well, the pleasure's all mine, of course. Now, Jeremy, before getting to the article, the debate was an unmitigated disaster, I argue. Despite the Democratic Party's revisionist gaslighting, does this spell the end of Bungalow Joe, do you think?
It looks that way. You know, there's more and more article that he'd been not mentally sound over the last 6 to maybe 10 months. And I think there's a growing chorus within the Democratic Party. Maybe this was their plan all along, but I think, you know, to have a chance at defeating Trump, they have to find somebody else.
Well, so who's that somebody else going to be? What's the process? I mean, assuming that Joe is convinced to fall on his sword, what happens next?
Well, this is kind of shady because, I mean, they kind of, you know, they deliberately seem to have barred the traditional primary process from occurring. They didn't allow any challengers. You know, there was Robert F. Kennedy was a challenger who had a lot of support, and they basically kicked him out of the party. And there was no real primary process, even though, you know, according to these reports, like New York Times has an article today, that it's been months that people knew that Biden was in mental decline.
If we're honest, it's been years.
Years. So, I mean, why didn't they have a legitimate primary? Because I think they want to, you know, carry out a kind of coup. I mean, they don't want a real democratic process. You know, we've seen in election after election how the party power brokers manage the party and ensure their candidates, the corporatists, get in, and that any candidate who smacks of populism or more, you know, in tune with the working class people of the country, like, you know, Bernie Sanders, who's has his flaws, but his policies are more progressive on a lot of the issues, certainly economic issues. But they made sure that he wouldn't be the nominee in 2016 and 2020. And you can go back in history to how they've rigged primaries or carried out coups to block more progressive candidates, like in the past, Henry Wallace, who favored cooperation with the Soviet Union. They made sure he didn't get in. They carried out a coup against him in 1944. So this is just, I think, continuing that process, and it exposed the hollow shell of American democracy, when in fact the parties are engineering their own corporatist candidates, and the public has very little say on who these candidates are.
Well, it was always interesting to me that Kennedy decided to run at all, and I thought when he first approached the prospect that he was hoping to sidle in with the Democratic Party. He's been a controversial figure and on the quite fringy in mainstream political discourse and out of the loop, but he still has that Kennedy name and everything else. But yesterday, if there was to be any hint of him sidling back into the party and usurping the nomination, or a stab at it, at least, that seems that the press is ready to put that down with these revelations of his past of alleged sexual assault.
Oh, I didn't follow. I'll take a look at that story. But yeah, they're going to make sure he's not. I mean, particularly because he spoke out against the pharmaceutical industry and took a brave stand on, you know, the COVID-19 issue, and has exposed a lot of corruption and in medical science, you know, the gain of function research and the intelligence agency support for gain of function research and the manufacturing of diseases, part of biowarfare. So that, you know, they're not going to let him anywhere near a position of power. And they've been disparaging it in the media for years now. And there's no pretense of any objectivity in covering him at all. So I don't know about the latest allegations, if there's any truth to it, but wouldn't be surprised. It would fit a pattern if they were manufactured allegations.
And now when you talk about the fix being in with the Democrats, this is nothing new. In fact, RFK's uncle, the lauded greatest president of the 20th century, you know, at least most charismatic, John F. Kennedy, the fix was in for him too, though. He didn't walk in exactly in a legitimate way when he won office either, did he?
No, well, his father, you know, I mean, the Kennedy dynasty resulted, you know, it showed where power in America lied, because the Kennedy dynasty resulted from the big money of Joseph P. Kennedy, who was the Wolf of Wall Street, you know, in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, and, you know, he bankrolled their campaign, so he had the big money that he could put up. And he had a lot of the political connections and connection with organized crime, who helped fix the election for John F. Kennedy. And John F. Kennedy was just kind of like a young, you know, playboy, never taken any principled political stands prior to becoming president. And he was kind of weak. You know, he was allied with the Americans for Democratic Action, which was the more conservative wing of the Democratic Party. And he disparaged Henry Wallace, who was more progressive in that era, who had advocated for cooperation with the Soviet Union and, you know, world peace, basically, dismantling U.S. overseas military bases. But Kennedy attacked him. You know, he was an internationalist, they called it in those days, and proponent of the American century. And he had his father's big money to catapult his career. And of course, he had the good looks and the charm to get there. But so that's characteristic of American politics.
Well, yeah. Well, and Kennedy had that a time. John F. Kennedy had the timing where he was a young guy in an age where the post-war generation was set to take over and move in a different direction. But then again, he also had the backing of the old school in the form, and this is getting to your article, Joe Biden's mentor, father of original Cold War, was traitor to U.S. family company, sold fuel additive to Nazi Air Force. This character that you outline in this article is absolutely fascinating. I've heard of Harriman before and Harriman's connections to the Nazi and Harriman Brown, the banking outfit. But W. Averill Harrell, in reading your article, he has not only did he know the Kennedys and support John F. Kennedy, but he seems to have been at the center of this American century that you you mention in a really intimate way, that I would say maybe he's even the most important political figure of the 20th century, American political figure that nobody really knows about.
Absolutely. He was a key figure. And there's a book called The Wise Men, you know, Six Friends in the World They Made. And he's one of them, you know, Dean Acheson, Robert Lovett, you know, I forget all, George Kennan. These were key figures who were orchestrating U.S. foreign policy in the Cold War, in the early Cold War. And they promoted the vision of the American century. You know, they subscribed to notions of American exceptionalism, and they wanted to project American power. They thought American-dominated world order would be a great world order. And Harriman, though, had a background. You know, his father was one of the robber barons in the Gilded Age, who made a fortune in the railway industry. And then he founded the leading Wall Street investment firm and merged with Brown Brothers. It was Harriman Brothers, him and his brother. And then they merged with Brown Brothers. And now Brown Brothers had a past. Like in Central America, they took over like the banking and economies of a numerous Central American country like Nicaragua. And they were very involved in some of the imperialistic intrigues of the 1920s. And then Brown Brothers Harriman, some of their top clients were actually Nazi financiers of the Nazi Party. And then Harriman was appointed to, and so he was a traitor basically to the United States. I believe there was credible investigation evidence, a violation of the Trading with the Enemy Act, because some of those relations with those Nazi financiers continued even after the United States went to war with Nazi Germany. And Harriman developed very ardent anti-communism because he had a lot of investments in like mining and natural resources, and his Wall Street firm invested in those industries, like in Eastern Europe and in countries that became part of the Soviet Union. And so in the Soviet Union nationalized industry, Harriman Brothers lost out on a lot of their investments. And they didn't want that model of socialist government, of nationalized industry, to expand around the world, because that would cut into their bottom line, enormous profit-making ability. And also perhaps they believed in the virtues of free market and free trade. They could benefit tremendously from that kind of economic order. So Harriman developed into a Cold War hawk. He was an ambassador to the Soviet Union, appointed by Franklin Roosevelt. And then he was against Henry Wallace. And actually, James Roosevelt, Franklin's son, said that his father, you know, Franklin was able to control these hawks in the State Department. He was referring to Harriman, who were these anti-Soviet hawks. But then when FDR died and this coup took place to remove Wallace, who was FDR vice president, Truman came in, and Truman didn't even have a college education. He was a simpleton from Missouri who was put in by the Pendergast political mafia machine. And so they could manipulate him, whereas Roosevelt could control them, these hawks. Truman was just somebody they could manipulate. So Harriman, you know, he became the administrator of the Marshall Plan, and he served in various high positions. And yeah, there was this circle with Kennan and Acheson and Robert Lovett. Most had a background on Wall Street. Like Lovett was also on Wall Street, and he was a defense secretary under Truman during the Korean War. and they championed the Cold War and NATO and the Korean War. And yeah, Harriman administered the Marshall Plan. And, you know, some of those funds were used for like covert programs to undermine left-wing movements and like to interfere in the 1948 Italian elections to prevent the political left from coming in. Then Harriman became governor of New York State, and yeah, they said, his biographer said his policies resembled more Herbert Hoover than Franklin Roosevelt. So he was a Democrat, but he was really a conservative Democrat. Then he served in the State Department under Kennedy in very high positions. As a Cold War hawk, he supported the Vietnam War for years. PR person for the Johnson administration during key period of escalation. And, you know, John F. Kennedy escalated the Vietnam War, and U.S. Military advisors and funding for the Diem government in South Vietnam that they were championing as kind of anti-communist antidote to Ho Chi Minh. And Harriman was all aboard that and supporting program like the Strategic Hamlet, where they moved peasants, you know, forced them away from their homes into model villages, usually through violence. And this is the guy who mentored Joe Biden in the Senate, and he and his wife ended up, you know, became when he retired, he used his fortune to support the Democratic Party. And candidates like Joe Biden, who would, you know, turn the party into really more of a conservative party and support hawkish, you know, foreign policy that would uphold the American century and support more conservative economic agenda.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Jeremy Kuzmarov. Jeremy is a scholar, journalist, and author. He holds a PhD in American history and has taught at various institutions of higher learning across the U.S. He writes, too, for Covert Action magazine and serves as that publication's managing editor online. Check them out, Cam. His book titles include Obama's Unending Wars, The Russians Are Coming Again, written with John Marciano, and his latest is Warmonger, How Clinton's Malign Foreign Policy Launched the U.S. Trajectory from Bush to Biden. Well, talking about Joe Biden again, and I'm really interested in how Harriman just slides back and forth between business and government naturally as the ebb and flow of the Republican-Democratic duopoly plays itself out. And it wouldn't really matter. He seems that he would be, as you say, as comfortable in either party, maybe even more so in the Republican Party. You and I, Jeremy, talked, I don't know, about a year, maybe even more than a year ago now, about Biden and his connections to the DuPont family and how he was basically the DuPonts. They run Delaware, and he represents Delaware. How did he manage to end up with Harriman? Did that precede his adoption by the DuPont family in Delaware?
Well, that's a good point to bring up the DuPonts, and you see the kind of, I mean, how American politics really works, and that it's really not a democracy but an oligarchy, that these powerful and rich people fund politicians basically to do their bidding. And it really takes unprincipled people like Biden, who will lie to the public and basically do what the rich folk tell them to do and screw over the public. And they're, you know, that's why politicians have a reputation worse than used car salesmen. And in his case, yeah, I mean, well, I think with Harriman is that what Biden wrote in his memoir, Promises to Keep, was that when he got to the Senate, now DuPont, I think, helped him get to the Senate and continue to fund his campaign, you know, the senator in Delaware as part of quid pro quo. And when he got into the Senate, Harriman was a key mentor to him in the Senate. That's what he said, and he described in the memoir how they traveled to Yugoslavia together after the death of Joseph Tito, and Harriman was telling him that, oh, one day, because, you know, Tito, an independent socialist who kept Yugoslavia part of the non-aligned movement and independent of manipulation by foreign powers. But Harriman told Biden on this trip, one day Yugoslavia will be in our orbit. And lo and behold, when Joe Biden was part of the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he championed U.S. efforts to support secessionist movement to break up Yugoslavia as part of a strategy of divide and conquer, really. And, you know, he supported the bombing including in Serbia. The goal was to remove Slobodan Milosevic, who had favored keeping the Yugoslav Federation together and was the last socialist leader in the region. And the end effect was that the U.S. got the Camp Bondsteel, you know, major military bases, and was able to influence the region very heavily and push free market policies away from the socialistic policies. So, Harriman kind of dictated that strategy for Biden. And I think he mentored him when he was a senator. And then the Harriman's PAC support, because they set up a political action committee. Avril and his wife Pamela Harriman, who had been married to Winston Churchill's son, and they poured money into these conservative, hawkish, imperialistic Democrats like Bill Clinton. They're called the New Democrats, like Bill Clinton and Joe Biden types and Hillary Clinton types. And that turned the party away from its New Deal roots and the more populist, pacifistic elements in the party, like the George McGovern and Frank Church, the more crusading elements, they lost out. They were kind of sidelined. But the Harriman money ensured the Clinton-Biden, Hillary Clinton wing prevailed. And that's what we see today in the Democrat. That wing prevails, and there are only a small number of genuine progressives in the party.
In reading, and when you're talking about his opinions on the former Yugoslavia and how they would bring it into America's orbit, he didn't just talk about that. He worked with it. And you write about his connections to the precursor to USAID. I kept thinking about George Soros. I thought, this guy sounds to me like the George Soros of his time.
A bit different that he actually served in the government. It shows that the government really... It's another example of how the government really represents the rich in society and Wall Street interests, that he was able to basically infiltrate the U.S. government and carry out policies that benefited Wall Street and his own financial interests. And that resulted in a very aggressive imperialistic foreign policy, including in the Kennedy years. He was part of the special group on counterinsurgency that whose goal was to stamp out left-wing movements all around the world and to support more covert counterinsurgency operations targeting those left-wing movements. That would uphold, the left-wing movements to oppose, because they wanted to redistribute wealth in their country, they wanted to nationalize industry, and they wanted to undercut U.S. investment and raise wages. And that's not good for U.S. corporations operating those countries. So they had to be destroyed, including through violent counterinsurgency policies. And Harriman was part of the elite body that planned those operations with Bobby Kennedy, who was known as kind of a gung-ho hardliner in those days. He later kind of transformed his public image to try and ride the wave of the 60s counterculture to gain office in 68 before he was tragically assassinated. But if you look into it, Bobby Kennedy was kind of very hawkish in supporting counterinsurgency, and he said he liked Avril, that these were like kind of action type oriented guys, they can get things done, and they had a clear ideological agenda, stamping out left-wing movements and it all around the world. And it related to in part Harriman's case, his naked economic self-interest of his company, Brown Brothers Harriman.
Well, and the way that he was involved in Iran, and these are the early years of CIA overthrows of governments. Iran was one of the first, Guatemala. I interviewed years ago economic hitman John Perkins. And in a sense, when you quote some of Harriman's comments about Mohammad Mossadegh, the ousted premier or prime minister of Iran that led to the reign of the Shah and all that followed, and the way he was talking about about Mossadegh's opinion, saying he's, quote, foolish in ignoring his my advice and quixotic in his thinking. That reminded me of what John Perkins was saying about the economic hitmen, when they go in and they kind of butter up the leaders and then say, well, look, we wouldn't want to see anything bad happen to this nice country of yours, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, there's this kind of real patronizing attitude and, you know, pure colonial mentality that this, you know, the West has the right to dictate how they manage their economy, and that anybody promoting genuinely nationalistic policies is somehow, use this language of quixotic, or they use very negative language to describe those kind of leaders, as if they're kind of foolish and backward in their thinking, or, you know, they're just, uses kind of Orientalist type stereotypes to describe him. So it's a pure colonial mentality, and he's involved in pure colonial operations, undermining nationalist leaders and helping to secure Western, the natural resources of Iran and other countries for Western corporations, including the oil corporations.
Well, and what a century it's been. And you look through this article and you can trace American politics back and the influence this guy has had on not only the politicians of his time, but the politicians that followed his time, and also the organizations and institutions that run America behind the scenes, you know, whether it's USAID or even the Rockefellers or Columbia University. This guy seems to have been everywhere at the birth of the Marshall Plan that really designed what we see today, modern Europe, and in Asia too, and in Korea. I mean, the guy's fingerprints are all over the modern world.
Absolutely, yeah, all over the American century, and a lot of it's ugly featured, including, you know, the Korean War was a horrific war that he championed that resulted in the death of something like one-tenth of the North Korean population and bombing literally back to the Stone Age, and huge atrocities and a permanent division of Korea that, you know, scarred the country. I mean, it divided families, and you have this terrible military standoff that continues to this day. The war didn't even ever end, really. So there are just some horrific legacies. And, you know, he funds and has corrupted higher education, because he funds the Harriman Institute at Columbia is a leading institute for Russian studies in the United States, and kind of sets the path for Russian studies across the country. And they promote his jilted view about Russia that, you know, supports American, you know, imperialistic intervention in Russia, and would support kind of Russian leader that Russian don't want, you know, leader that would just sell out their country to Western interest, like Boris Yeltsin. So that I mean, it's not a free academic environment. It just promotes the ideological agenda of Wall Street, and a lot of it is very Russophobic, and there's no free debate. If you a Russian expert who wants to explain Putin and why he's popular in the Russian population, or, you know, would support a strong Russia and advocate for policies that kind of stand up to the United States bullying, you're not going to get a job at the Harriman Institute. You'll probably be blacklisted, or you won't be invited for a lecture. Your writing won't be assigned. And you'll probably be blacklisted in higher education in general. So it's distorted the entire intellectual landscape of the country, how we view Russia, as it's led to Russophobia. So that's just one area. You know, he'd been very influential to this day, because his fortune has funded this academic institution that's, again, a trendsetter in the field of Russian studies, and it has corrupted higher education. You know, these wealthy interests corrupted higher education in the country. So they're very, very negative legacies associated with this guy. The class interests, it's ultimately about the class interests that he represents. And I think a lot of Americans are oblivious to the class rule, although more and more are waking up to it now, because it's more and more obvious how this elite 1-2% rule the country in their own agenda and distort a lot of the policies.
I wonder if he looked around today what he would think and if it would be something that he would maybe regret. The article is Joe Biden's mentor, father of original Cold War, was traitor to U.S. family companies, sold fuel additive to Nazi Air Force. That's Jeremy Krasmarov at covertactionmagazine.com. Thanks a lot, Jeremy, for coming on again and telling us a little bit about it, eh?
My pleasure. Yeah, it's a very interesting story.
Well, and I want everyone else to stay tuned after the break. Eve Engler is going to be back, and we're going to talk a little bit about things a little closer to home this week, Canada, afterbirth. And I know you're Canadian too, Jeremy, so happy afterbirth Canada Day to you.
Thanks. Same to you.
Okay, till the next time.
Take care.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago. Jakarta. Helsinki. Cape Town.